Okay, so obviously I have not been here in the last 3 weeks with just the deepest affection and appreciation. I marvel at Lenny's stepping up on extremely short notice. I confess that I have not listened to his lessons, though, or anybody else's while I've been going, you know, so I don't know what he's taught, and therefore I hope I don't repeat, you know, too much. But now, when I left the pulpit, we were still at the end of that 15th chapter, and then therefore Paul's Jerusalem Council, as we typically call it. Now we're very deep into the second journey, and so I would like to spend a little bit of time doing our memory work to begin with, and then working on a map here, and we'll get on into chapter 17, the start of chapter 17 in just a minute. So to make it easy for you, what's chapter 1's headline? It's absolutely right. What's chapter 2's? Okay, we have church established in Peter's. Okay, and then chapter 3 is, I'll give it to you. So it's necessarily then Peter's second sermon. Chapter 3, I'll give you that one. Okay, Peter and John get arrested. It's Peter's third sermon. And with chapter 4, with chapter 3 and that healing of the lame man, these next several chapters are all built on that. It's that event that provokes everything that follows for quite a long ways there. And Peter and John are now arrested because of it. So you tell me what happens in chapter 5. Yeah, yeah. Ananias and Sapphira. That's what he called her. And Sapphira. Yeah, we have our first problem then. What kind of a problem is it? It's a moral problem. What happens in chapter 6? Okay, we have another problem. We have another problem. A second problem. It's a logistical problem. It's a mechanical problem. It's a physical problem. And so the seven are chosen to take care of the widows that have been overlooked. In chapter 7 we have Stephen's defense. And therefore the first person who is killed for their faith. The first person who must pay that ultimate price because he believes the truth. The first that is opposed so thoroughly that it results in the end of his life. The first triumphant proof that we can keep the faith even unto death. What happens in chapter 8? And I give it to you because it's kind of a tough one. It's one of those busy chapters. Chapter 8, though the gospel has gone from Jerusalem through Judea to Samaria, as was prophesied at the end of Luke and at the start of Acts chapter 1. So we get into the Samaritan conversions. We have that sorcerer confrontation. The Ethiopian eunuch that is also converted. And so we have a very busy chapter with conversions and conversions and conversions. Chapter 9 is Paul's conversion. And then I've added this, but Peter's in Lydda, and he's also in Joppa. And so we've got both men involved. It's another one of those busy chapters. Not real easy to just say, well, this is what happened, because several things happened. Chapter 10 is conversion. So chapter 11 is the same thing. We have the church in Antioch as well, but what's the difference between Cornelius' conversion in chapter 10 and the story of Cornelius' conversion in chapter 11? What's the difference between the two? Yeah, exactly that. It is the same conversion. But we have the history of it in chapter 10. Then we have the problems that flow out of it, because immediately all kinds of Christians, including the apostles, are disturbed and concerned, and there's going to have to be an answer for this. And so Peter has to go and deal with the apostles in Jerusalem, who are unsure about his behavior. Chapter 12. Chapter 12 is Peter's second arrest, and a brief story about the death of Herod Agrippa, the most interesting one, corroborated by Josephus, for instance. What happens in chapter 13 and 14 is our first journey. Now, that's one that is easy to remember and you'll want to remember. So we turn the corner. At the end of chapter 12, everything changes. We move from Jerusalem being the chief city, from the Jews being the chief people. You know, we suddenly have the push that God now has been prophesying. We've seen it innumerable times in Isaiah, in our studies on Wednesday night, and we see now, you know, the very formal presentation of the gospel to the Gentiles. Now, it started in 10 and 11, but 13 and 14 are the missionary journeys. So from this point to the rest of the book, throughout all the rest of the book, who's the chief person? It's Paul. Who was it the first 12 chapters? Peter, chiefly. Okay, and so now it is Paul. What was the chief city? It's Jerusalem before. What is it now? It's Antioch of Syria, where all of the missionary journeys begin, and two of them end, after which, the end of the third one, he's going to be arrested. Paul's going to be arrested. So 13 and 14, you want to remember that. And then who are the chief people? We have the Jews in the first 12 chapters. Now we have the Gentiles. Now, the Gentiles came up in 10 and 11, you know, but the last part of the book is going to focus on them. So again, or what happens in chapter 15, Jerusalem Conference, as we call it. I thought that was going to pop up, and it didn't, so I can't explain that. What happens in chapter 3 now? I'm going to put them out of order, so you tell me. I've already got it up. Okay, you and layman, Peter's second sermon. What happens in chapter 8? Samaria. What happens in chapter 4? I gave you the clue. Okay, Peter and John are arrested because they healed the lame man, and so now we have Peter's third sermon. Chapter 1. Sure, that was easy. Chapter 5. Ananias and Sapphi. Okay, first problem. Oh my God, look at myself when my eyes work. Okay, chapter 2. Yeah, it's really easy. Establishment of the church takes place there. Okay, how about chapter 6? Choosing the 7. Second problem. What happens in chapter 7? Stephen's defense and murder. Then chapter 9. Boy, I got somebody over here in the corner who's really got them all. So now we have the first of three times that Paul's conversion is told. Then we got Peter pretty busy as well. Chapter 10. Cornelius' conversion. Chapter 11. Explaining Cornelius' version, and we get Paul up to Syrian Antioch. Chapter 12. Okay, Peter's second arrest. Death of Herod Agrippa the First. Chapter 13. Okay, chapter 14. Same thing. Chapter 15. Jerusalem Conference. Chapter 16, which Lenny taught, is the second journey. It's actually the tail end of 15. I'll show you that in a minute. But the second journey begins. And in the 16th chapter, Lydia's going to be converted, the jailer's going to be converted, and maybe the book of James is written, but we will never know. You can't know when James was written. The 16 is pivotal. We're going to call it second journey. And we get conversions again. What's the book of Acts all about? The Acts of the Apostles. The Acts of the Apostles. What were the apostles so busy acting on? Conversions. Bringing people to Christ. So, James may have written his epistle in that area there. That's a very viable possibility, but can't know for sure. Now, this morning we're going to start chapter 17. What is chapter 17 about? 17 is also the second journey. First journey is two chapters, 13 and 14. Second journey, chapters 16 and 17 so far. And we've got now Thessalonica, Berea, and this time I made the Athens, in bold print. And those of you that are looking at the notes I'm giving you, I keep tweaking this. There's slight differences. I added that line right there. I added Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe in chapter 14. I'll never be satisfied. Maybe when the class is over, I'll put up a new one. You know when I finally got in. But, it's journeying. It's all these different cities. And so in a moment, we're going to be looking at Thessalonica, very famous city. Of course, two epistles will be written there. Berea, very famous city. Everybody wants to be like them. Athens, one of the longer and more beautiful sermons that's presented. Paul's lengthy presentation to these Gentile idolaters and philosophers in Athens. So this is where we are at this point. Now, the only other thing I want to do in the class this morning is to talk about this map. So I'm always looking for a new map, trying to change them up on you too, so you get used to seeing different maps. Hopefully that helps you to get used of different ways of having it presented, so it'll stick for you. What shape was the first journey. It's shaped like a sea. Where does it start? Antioch of Syria, right there. And it's shaped like a sea. Where do you go first? Through that island of Cyprus, and then you work up through this region and back again in a sea. That's the first journey, two chapters, which are 13 and 14. You are shaving milliseconds off your answer every time. Okay, even better. Now, we're back in Antioch. Everybody open, though, first this morning to 15:39. There arose such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another, and Barnabas took Mark with him. Mark's behavior was the point of the controversy, and he sailed away to Cyprus. They did. But in 40, Saul chose Silas and departed, being committed, by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. And he was traveling through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. So, there between verses 38 and 39, right in the margin of your Bible, start second journey. Does the second journey start amicably? Everybody happy? No, it starts acrimoniously. Christians have problems. They cross swords. Is that going to get resolved later? Yeah, we'll read later. They'll get back together again. But, that kind of stuff happens. And then this black line right here shows, where did Barnabas and his cousin go? Back to Cyprus. And we have no idea where they went after that. Okay? But what did they do? On Barnabas' second journey, what did he do? Went right back, where he started on the last one. And as a matter of fact, up here in Antioch, in this blue part right here, we have Paul and Silas going through Asia Minor in Acts 15, verse 40 through 16:10. So all the blue part here is going through what is known as Asia Minor, but today it would be called Turkey. This is Turkey. Okay? And so as you set off like this, it probably doesn't say so, but you go to Tarsus. Why? What's Tarsus all about? Paul was born there. Maybe his parents are still there. So you go back to Tarsus probably, but it's also very natural because here are what are called the Cilician Gates. It's a path through the Taurus mountain range right here, main road, thoroughfare and all that, so that's very likely that's how he went. And then what do you notice about this journey? Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, Antioch. First journey, chapters 13 and 14. And so Paul, when he steps out this way, he's doing that second half of that first journey. What are Paul and, Barnabas and Mark doing? They're doing the first part. Okay? Now, it's too bad. There was this problem, between the two guys. But one way to look at it is, first, there doesn't appear to be any sin in the matter, but they couldn't work together. And because they couldn't work together, what happened? You get twice as much work done. So, maybe really, best thing could have happened. They probably didn't think so at the time, but best thing that could happen. So, fine, let's go and do that then. So, we're going to pass through the city of Antioch, and at that point, we're in new territory for Paul, aren't we? He didn't get up in here, in the central and northern part of Turkey, Asia Minor, on the first journey, but he's getting in new territory now, and you will have studied with Lenny, he couldn't go south. Why? Spirit wouldn't let him. Couldn't go north because Spirit wouldn't let him. He has already come from the east, so he only got one direction left. What's he going to do? He's going to head north. And he's going to get all the way out here to the port city of Troas, as far west as you can get. Now, again, my apologies. Lenny may have talked about all of this, and I don't in any way want to cast any doubt on what he did, or hopefully he don't repeat too much of it. But I would like for everybody to come back to, I've got to find it myself now, chapter 16 and verse 10. In chapter 16 and verse 10, I'd have you make a note in the margin. Who joins the group early on in the second journey, and here in Troas, in 16:10, Luke joins the group. So Paul and Silas had set out, but now all of a sudden in verse 10, how do we know Luke is there? pronouns. When he had seen the vision, immediately we. All of a sudden it goes from he and they did this and that to we. Apparently Luke joins the group in Troas. Now, real quick, if you got your pencil handy, circle every we or us. So the first one's in verse 11. Then you go to the very end, toward the end of verse 12. There's a we. Early in verse 13, there's a we. In the middle of 13, there's a we. And in the last part of 13, there's a we. And then you get to 15 in the middle, there's an us. And the last word in verse 15 is also us. Just circle them. In 16, it happened as we. Circle that we, and then toward the middle of the earth, you know, met us. So there's a we and an us. Then in 17, early on, Paul and us, and that's all of them. So you got we and us. It's very noticeable. What happened? The author changed the way he's addressing his audience. It was what they were doing, and now it's what we're doing. So that's the only clue we have, but it's a pretty serious one. Apparently Luke joins the group up here at Troas. Who's already joined the group back here? Timothy. Timothy has also joined the group. So you now have Paul and Silas who set out, Timothy who joined them midway, and Luke is a part of the bundle when we hit Troas. Okay? Now then, let's back to the map. This group is now in the yellow section here, which will take us to Athens. So again, Lenny covered all this. Just give me the map. They're now in Greece. They were in Asia Minor. They're crossing the water. They're heading into Macedonia, which / is also Greek. Greece, Macedonia, and Achaia, all of those, you know, you think of, Simon says, fit together, in chapter 16:11 through chapter 18:17. So, we're going to have more. Today we're going to look at chapter 17. We've seen two chapters already devoted to this second journey. It's a journey. So they're going to come across here to Neapolis and Philippi. Jail in chapter 16, very important conversion there, the jailer. Amphipolis, Apollonia, and way up here in this arm of, you know, the water there, right at the top is the seaport of Thessalonica. I'm not going to show you any pictures in this class. We're going to go right to the text now. But the photograph you'll see at the start of the sermon is of that port city. Just looking down the hill, you know, at the water. So there's Thessalonica. Now, obviously, brethren, Thessalonica has this wonderfully sheltered harbor, and it's up here in the northern shores of Macedonia and, you know, Greece, Achaia, right there. And, you know, you got Troas, obviously, the seaport vision. I can't say vision because it's got vision on the map, so the Macedonian vision took place, but, you know, a seaport that's so important to, you know, travel, commerce. Thessalonica, then, is a heavily trafficked area. It's an important city in the Roman Empire. It is naturally, geographically, very appealing. Sheltered harbor for a seaport, you know, sea traffic. It's on the main roads. It's just, you know, right there in that line. So in a moment, we're going to look at the very first of chapter 17, and there's Thessalonica. Now, to finish it out, looks like he went by sea, though to tell you the truth, we're not totally sure, but came down probably by sea and hit Athens. That's the last half of chapter 17. Then he's going to come over to Corinth. Now we get to cities, you know, we're familiar with. And finally, going to sail all the way back over here to Ephesus and then down to Caesarea, of course. That's the port and capital city for the Romans in Israel. And then down here to Jerusalem, they show the dotted line that must have gone back up the Antioch of Syria, because we're told that that's where the third journey is taking off. So if the first journey is a sea, what's the second journey? Well, I don't know what you call it. It's a stretch circle or, you know, I don't know what you call it. But it's a lot bigger, isn't it? This is about a three-year journey. Dates are all tentative. You can't really nail them down, you know, that we haven't found Paul's cell phone yet. It has the calendar and all the dates, but it's probably, in my recommendation, it's 49 and 50 and 51. This is a three-year journey. I think they got it up here.
spend a year and a half just in Corinth. Spends half that time in Corinth. So he's staying, you know, appreciable lengths of time. He's accomplishing tremendous amounts of work. The gospel is meeting with great success and a rising tide of opposition. The more successful you are, the more opposition you're likely to have. So here's where we are in 49, 50, and 51. Paul's traveling through this region. Now please, everybody open to 17:1, and here we go. In 17:1, when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. So what do you guess? Luke didn't stay very long on this journey, did he?
Luke starts in Troas. Apparently all he does is sail across the sea, but he gets to see a lot of good stuff in Philippi. He goes down the coastline area, Amphipolis, Apollonia, hits Thessalonica, and he turns and waves bye-bye.
Now he knows what happens. He's going to meet with Paul again. He's an inspired New Testament writer. He doesn't need anybody to tell him what to write. God's telling him what to write, but the pronoun changed. So make a note. Apparently, Luke stays behind. Okay? And, in Philippi. I think I said Thessalonica a minute ago. But he probably stays in Philippi. Philippi, yes, correct that. Okay, so he's very briefly on this journey. Is he converted on this journey? Has hands laid on him miraculously to be able suddenly to be, you know, a preacher? I don't know. But it's a pretty brief time with Paul, and then he's talking in third person again. They're taking care of that. I'm not with them. Okay, so in 17:1, make the note. Luke apparently stays in Philippi, and then in verse 1, when they had traveled through Amphipolis, Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. So from Philippi, which is pretty much just what you'd say straight across from Troas, Neapolis being the port, and Philippi a few miles inland. Then as you move further west, Amphipolis and Apollonia are on its double line, Thessalonica is at the end of the bay. So now we're in Thessalonica. In Thessalonica, they go into a synagogue of the Jews because, as the first words show in verse 2, that's Paul's what? That's his custom. That's what Paul always does. The gospel is to the Jew first, and then to the Gentiles. So the Jews have the background. The Jews have the familiarity with the Old Testament. The Jews should be able to accept the gospel first. The Jews can be helpful in the proclamation of the gospel since they know their Old Testaments if they become Christians. So let's start with them. And then immediately we got an army of guys that can start teaching. So Paul goes to the synagogue. He always goes to the synagogue first. According to Paul's custom in verse 2, he went to them. And for three Sabbaths, he reasoned with them from the scriptures. So, three Sabbaths would be three what days of the week? Saturday, which then means he stayed there at least how long? 3 weeks. And every Saturday, when the Jews were doing their custom of keeping the Sabbath, he goes in there and he reasons with them from the scriptures. Pardon me? And we'll take a while to get the oil. Maybe it's time for that chocolate, you know, to kind of lubricate the things out there, you know. And every time I come back after a break, my voice is always raw like that. So, Paul goes on, and he is reasoning with them from the scriptures. Does the passage say that Paul is keeping the Sabbath? No. Does the passage say that he's breaking the Sabbath? Does the passage tell you anything about what he's doing on, you know, except what he's doing on the Sabbath? Okay, can anybody rightfully argue that this proves that Christians led by Paul are keeping the Sabbath? It doesn't say anything of the type. So the Seventh-day Adventists and your Seventh-day Baptists and so many other groups, you know, that they get so derailed by this, it's just really poor thinking. So, sorry for that, you know, they don't know how to reason from the scriptures, they're just doing a poor job with grammar, you know, and deciding to read into it what the scripture never says. I grew up Catholic. If I go and into a, as I did just about a year ago, wanted to see the old stomping grounds, you know, so I went back to St. Joseph's Catholic Church. And I walked in and sat down in the pew and relived my childhood for a little while. It was very eerie. Okay? And so I come out of there and I tell y'all I went to a Catholic church on a Sunday. Does that make me a Catholic? Did I keep the Mass? Did I celebrate a Mass? What does it say? I was in the Catholic church building on a Sunday. What's that say about the Mass? Nothing. Okay? Don't accuse me of it. And so there's no keeping of the Sabbath here. Why does he go into that Sabbath? Why does he go to that synagogue? That's where all the Jews are on a week. In a week, where are you going to find all the Jews? Saturday in the synagogue. Okay? Does Paul understand all their customs and all their behaviors and their lingo? Is he one of them? Was he not a great leader among them before he became Christian? And so, it's only natural. It also does not say that at this point Paul had second thoughts about being a Christian, and so he fell away from the faith and became a Jew.
What does it say about him keeping the Sabbath? I mean, the Lord's Sabbath.
Also nothing.
Shouldn't it?
Well, yeah, but does it say anything about it? No. So it also says nothing about the Lord's Supper. It says nothing about most things. What color were his sandals? Did he have a real dark brown leather on that day? Was it his formal sandals? So I don't know. Now, was Paul eating of the Lord's Supper all the way, you know, along the way? Did Paul eat the Lord's Supper at Tarsus? Did he eat it in Derbe or Lystra or Iconium or Antioch? Well, how do you know that?
Well, yeah, he's a Christian and he does what God
says. Well, yeah, see, so I think he did. But does the Scripture say he did? No. And so, I don't know. Because, I don't know, maybe he was in Lystra on a Tuesday. And he left on a Thursday. So did he take the Lord's Supper in Lystra? Well, if he wasn't there on a Sunday, I don't know. Now, brother, one of the more important aspects, I think, of all Bible study is to remember, I don't know is an okay position to occupy. And when you don't know, be vigorously faithful in that conviction. Camp on that. I don't know. Now, go find out if you can, and if God doesn't tell you, then what will be the case for the rest of your life? You'll never know. I don't know.
Deuteronomy 29:29.
Excellent. Which says?
The secret things belong to God.
That is right. But the things that are revealed belong to us and our children. That's the rest of that verse. It's a secret thing. So I'm satisfied with that. That's just fine. Probably better off not knowing. I know a lot of things I wish I didn't know.
One thing about going to synagogue is that if there were any proselytes there, they were people who were very interested in their soul, and that gets them out into the community, and that's why the nations start coming and gets in his toe in the water the other direction.
I'm guessing this is why Cornelius is such a figure in chapters 10 and 11. He's an influential guy among the both of them, isn't he? He said, Jews, you're right. To the Gentiles, you're right. But because he's a convert to Judaism, he's associating with the Jews. He's learning about the Old Testament. So you make him a Christian, and there you go. Okay, so I can't answer those questions. Then, in verse, I do know what he did. Well, here's another note for you. At verse 2, I've written in my margin, supported by Philippians 4:15-16. So some way or another, collect Philippians 4, verses 15 and 16. I'm going to turn back and read it here to 17:2. Here's what it says in Philippians. You yourselves also know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving but you alone. For even in Thessalonica you sent more than once for my needs. What are Philippians 4, 15, and 16 talking about? 17:2. He had just left Philippi, and apparently also just left behind Luke. Okay. He goes to Thessalonica. And then they sent money to him more than once. Just like we do with Jim Putterbach. Sent more money, so I can do the work. So make sure you get the note at verse 2. Paul tells us in the Philippian letter that right then he was getting gifts from Philippi, and they were the only people that were supporting him in his work at that time. And what he's doing is, in verse 2, reasoning with them from the Scriptures. In verse 3, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead. And he was saying, this Jesus whom I am proclaiming to you is the Christ. Christos is the Greek word that would be translated what? That's correct, but you're right on the Messiah thing. But I'm looking for, Messiah kind of doesn't tell us anything either. I mean, to translate it so you get what the word's about. Anointing. The anointed one. Okay, Christos is anointed. And then we get Messiah from that. It's all true because he is the anointed one. But it means to anoint. And so here's, he's the anointed one. Prophet, priest, and king. So what is Paul doing? In verse 2, he is reasoning. In verse 3, he is explaining. And also in verse 3, he is giving evidence. Here is the work of an evangelist. When you go out to bring people to Christ, what are you going to do if you're going to be like the most successful evangelist that there ever was? I don't think anybody can vie with Paul for the title. So what do? You reason with them. Logical progressions. You work through stretches, of mental activity. Stringing A plus B plus C equals thus and such. But all that reasoning is from what? It is from the Scriptures. Last word in verse 2. He's a Scripture reasoner. He's a guy who can handle those Scriptures. And with those Scriptures, he can draw conclusions and prove points and persuade people that Jesus is the Anointed One, Prophet, the Priest, and the King. And then he's also explaining. So probably questions are coming at him, verses are popping up that he wants to spend more time with. This also is the work of the evangelist. He goes to those same Scriptures and he explains. He helps people to understand. He can tie other Scriptures in with those, but he's fleshing out the meaning. So they've all got the Scriptures in that synagogue, but they don't understand the Scriptures. So the world that preachers live in is the explaining of what the Scriptures mean. And he is also giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead. Now you got to know, brethren, that's a tough thing to prove. Very few people just say, here's a story, this guy died for you and then he rose from the dead. Oh, okay, I believe it. No way, he rose from the dead. You need some kind of evidence. You need some kind of proofs. So he's using the Scriptures, I think, primarily for this. But let's remember, there might be one other way in verse 3 that Paul might give evidence that Christ had to suffer and raise from the dead. What could that possibly be? Signs and wonders. Paul says, there's this guy born in Bethlehem, raised in Nazareth. He is the anointed one. And then he was crucified for our sins, but 3 days later he rose from the dead. Now this is the way the Scriptures show that. So let's reason from the Scriptures and I'll explain Isaiah to you. And then they say, well, I don't know. I need a little more evidence than that. All right, let's go down the graveyard. I say unto you, arise.
That would work, wouldn't it? That's pretty good evidence. You know, Paul could raise something from the dead. Oh, looks like you're having a problem there. You know, you've only got one arm.
Well, you know, let's fix that. Yeah, I'm making them up. But miracles. He's signs and wonders are evidence. So likely Paul, who has these powers, is utilizing them. Then, in verse 4, after all of that, now I'm guessing a pretty, that Paul is a pretty decent reasoner. So I'm expecting that you're probably never going to see a better explainer. And he's got all the power of the Holy Spirit to give evidence with. And yet, in verse 4, did the whole city say, okay, that's enough for me? No, it's just some were persuaded. You know, some were. The way's still straight and narrow. And they joined Paul and Silas. Silas has been there through the whole thing, started over there in Antioch, Syria, along with a great multitude of the God-fearing Greeks. Now, brethren, what that suggests to me, the sum of them, who are the them? Where is Paul? What day of the week is it? It's the Sabbath. And some of them believed him. But a great multitude along with that of God-fearing Greeks and even a number of the leading women did what? They believed him. And by the way, we often wonder and sometimes maybe even represent the role of women in Old Testament times, both with regard to the Jews and with regard to the Gentiles, the whole Roman system and all the rest of that. But more than once in the book of Acts, you're going to come across some women who have this appellation, this adjective applied. They're what kind of women? They're leading women. They're powerful women. They're influential women. They cut quite a swath through the society there. You know, and I think this has always been the case, brethren. I get calls, it's fairly frequently from all over the country, I guess, and people asking questions and whatnot, and somebody was calling me about marriage and divorce and remarriage here not too long ago. And you wanted to know about the passage where it says that you make her commit adultery. Make her commit adultery. So raise your hand. How many times have you heard, well, back in that culture, for a Jewish woman, if she didn't have a husband, there's really only other option. You know, she either starves to death or she becomes a prostitute. So I've heard this, time and time and time again. Brothers, is that really so? Your only two options if you're a woman, the Jewish, is either starved to death or become a prostitute. There's nothing in between those two. Well, it's ridiculous. But that became very popular in churches of Christ. A lot of people bought into that. It just became the standard thing. If you ever preached on marriage and divorce, you'd get that. Everybody thought that. But they hadn't thought through it. And you find leading women among the Jews and among the Gentiles. It's not true at all. So you're like, what's Lydia all about? Very prosperous prostitute, right? No, she was a seller of purple. She's a very prosperous businesswoman, is what she was, down by the river with the rest of those Jewish women doing what? Worshiping God, praising God, praying down by the river. Looks to me like she had more than one option. A lot of things crop up, and then you hear it enough from the pulpit, and then you buy it, and it becomes a tradition, and before you know it, people build whole doctrines on marriage and divorce and remarriage on something that's really just palpably false, or it's ridiculous. So, Carol.
The worthy woman goes out and...
What's all Proverbs 31 about? Prostitution? No.
Married, but that if something happens, she's prepared to take care of herself.
Yeah, she's a leading woman. She's a successful woman. She's got her fingers in lots of different pies. It's busy. Okay.
Phoebe's recommended by Paul, Romans chapter 16. So remember, brethren, in every generation, Bible study starts over again. You don't inherit anything. The day you're baptized into Christ, what just happened? Starting all over again. A lifetime of Bible study. We are always
doing the same things in every generation and with everybody else, starting over again. What we're trying to do is to build a, you know, an ethic that says, let's study these scriptures out, find out exactly what they say, forget about all the traditions and all of that, and just get to what the book tells us. So, let's continue here. I've only got 5 more minutes, but I was hoping at least that I could get done with this and I could get down to verse 9 this morning, so let me press on here. So, some of them, which I think are Jews, were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, in verse 4, along with the great multitude, the God-fearing Greeks, and a number of the leading women. So in 5, but the Jews, becoming jealous, taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, that speaks real well of them, doesn't it? Formed a mob. I wonder, I wouldn't even know how to do that, I don't think. You know, apparently they're good at it. Formed them a mob, using these guys from the marketplace who were wicked men, and they set the city in an uproar. And coming upon the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. When they did not find them, didn't find Paul, didn't find Silas, didn't find Timothy, who's apparently with them at this time. Where's Luke? He's back in Philippi. Okay? So when they didn't find him, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also." And Jason has welcomed them. They all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there's another king, Jesus. And they stirred up the crowd and the city authorities who heard these things. And when they had received the pledge from Jason and the others, they released them. So they had a major dust-up, didn't they? And it's a big deal, it really is. Now, brethren, again, I don't know the society or what was going on in Thessalonica. I doubt that many of the city authorities, though, are going to be Jews. Now, that's possible. But it's a wholly Gentile city. And so it looks like, though, that these Jews, they had influence. They had, you know, power in and among the leadership of the city, the politicians, the power brokers here in Thessalonica. They're able to influence these guys. So, you know, whether or not some of them actually had reached those positions of power, unlikely, at least we know they had, you know, they had influence. Who else did they have influence with? The wicked guys down in the marketplace. Not speaking too well for these Jews, is it? Because they really do. They have influence where it counts. Wicked guys in the marketplace and the local, you know, mayor and his crew, whatever that is. Well, doesn't speak well for them at all. And we're told what their motivation is in verse 5. They're jealous. So because they're jealous, they're willing to stir the whole town up. They're willing to get Jason in a whole lot of trouble and maybe even killed. We've seen that before, starting in Acts chapter 7. With Stephen. Close enough. Acts chapter 7. So they're jealous. They form a mob. They set the city in an uproar. And then with the mob, they go race it off, you know, beating down Jason's doors and dragging him out. Couldn't find Paul, though. So they and some brethren, so that has to be Jewish brethren, not Christian brethren, brought up before the city authorities. They've upset the world. Have they upset the world? That's who they upset. These Jews. That's who they've upset. And then Jason's welcomed them. And they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar. Is that true at all? It's not true at all. But is there another king named Jesus? You bet there is. So they stirred up the crowd and it got some money from Jason. He had to pay bail. And then they released him. Okay? Thus ends our adventures in Thessalonica. Okay? Any comment or question? I didn't think so.